Welcome to another T-Rex Talk. Today is a very cold and rainy day in Tennessee. You can probably hear the rain. But I'm very happy to be working on one of the first days of production since the close of our Black Friday sale. We had a very good Black Friday sale. And we're very happy to have made a lot of sales. And now we get to make a lot of holsters. So that's going to be a focus for some weeks, and when we catch up, we'll be able to get our lead times back down to the, you know, the 1 to 5 days that we prefer. But I'm also really happy to be talking about this week's topic, which is the Bruin decision from the Supreme Court. Now, we've already talked about the Bruin decision in a previous podcast episode. In fact, if you would like to hear a real lawyer discuss this issue, you should go back and listen to that July 6th episode with Matt from Fudbusters. Matt is a real lawyer who works on real firearms cases, so his insight is much more useful and interesting and accurate than mine is. If you want to hear from a real lawyer, you should definitely go listen to that episode. It's probably about an hour-long conversation, if I remember that correctly. But even though I am not a lawyer, I want to revisit that Bruin decision. Not so much the decision, but the aftermath, the fallout, some of the fruit that Bruin decision has borne in the last few months. So the Bruin decision was handed down by the Supreme Court on June 23rd, and it was authored by the great Justice Clarence Thomas, who has been involved in a string of wins this year that I appreciate very much. New York State Rifle and Pistol Association Incorporated versus Bruin. That's why we just call it the Bruin decision. And it basically struck down the Sullivan Act, this very, very old gun control act that essentially made it almost impossible for New York citizens to get carry permits. New York State was a may issue state. They weren't required to issue carry permits. They had a really interesting and oftentimes very corrupt way of deciding who could actually get carry permits. And that was what was struck down by the Supreme Court, because to prevent people from carrying firearms for their own protection, to prevent them from bearing arms, is an infringement on the Second Amendment. Now, in addition to striking down that particular Sullivan Act, it also created a new test that courts must use in all Second Amendment cases. And the test goes like this. When the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct, which here is the right to bear arms, the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. The government must then justify its regulation by demonstrating that it is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Only then may a court conclude that the individual's conduct falls outside of the Second Amendment's unqualified command. Now, this is great because it recognizes that the Second Amendment has an unqualified command. Shall not be infringed does not have a whole bunch of qualifications attached to it. And so in order to suggest or make the case that there should be some qualifications to that, you need to go back to the historical record. You need to go back to the contemporaries of the founders and the laws of the founding era to determine if those qualifications were things that the founders would have had in mind. And this is great because at that time, there really weren't any qualifications. There really were no limitations on people's right to own and to bear arms. And those arms that are described in that Second Amendment include all armaments for offense and defense, not just a specific class of like hunting rifles. So the Bruin decision immediately nullified these very specific New York gun laws on June 23rd. Which meant that the New York legislature immediately panicked and opened a special legislative session so that they could pass a new wave of gun laws that they hoped would sidestep or bypass this decision, and they passed all those laws on July 1st. But this decision from the Supreme Court, the Bruin decision, has effects on all gun laws, not just the Sullivan Act, because if the Sullivan Act is unconstitutional, this same standard, this same test, will show that similar state laws are equally unconstitutional. So that immediately shines a spotlight on California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey, because those are all states with really similar may issue laws. And a bunch of those states address the Bruin decision by changing their laws, switching over to become shall issue states so that they would not be subject to lawsuits. lawsuits that they would invariably lose because they were in violation of the constitutional principle protected by the new test of the Bruin decision. And it isn't just states. There are towns and cities with unconstitutional gun laws that are now being affected by this Bruin decision. There are lawsuits that have been filed against them by a lot of different people. There were even some lawsuits that were sort of pending, and after the Bruin decision came down, the Bruin decision was added to their argumentation. And this year, ever since June or July, we have seen a lot of cases where the Bruin decision was cited by the judges when they made really good decisions. Now, there also have been some cases where judges have made the case that the Bruin decision doesn't apply, that that particular historical test is not relevant, but there have been some really big wins here. I tried to figure out, again, I am not a lawyer, so I could not figure out how to make a list of every single U.S. court case that has cited the Supreme Court Bruin decision. That's a really easy thing that probably the most green paralegal could do with their eyes closed, but I could not figure out how to do that. So I kind of cherry-picked some of the big cases because the Bruin decision is so big and so wide. It would not surprise me if it has already been cited in dozens or hundreds of cases, many of which are also under appeal. So that's going to keep happening. But these are some important cases. On July 22nd, this is less than a month after the Bruin decision, a Colorado federal judge granted a TRO and restrained the enforcement of a Colorado town's assault weapons ban. That was the Rocky Mountain Gun Owners versus Superior case. The town of Superior, Colorado, had a ban on assault weapons, and the judge said, hey, the way that you have singled out specific weapons is not in keeping with the Second Amendment and does not withstand the scrutiny of this new test that the Supreme Court has put forward on the constitutionality of gun laws. So you can no longer enforce that quote-unquote assault weapons ban. On August 25th, there was a case in Texas, and the judge, Mark Pittman, struck down a Texas law that had been prohibiting the concealed carry of 18 to 21-year-olds. This was, I should point out, the people that brought this lawsuit, the Firearms Policy Coalition, and the case was Andrews versus McCraw. And this was a very, very important step that I think that people will be able to build on in the future. And this is what the judge said. He said, the issue is whether prohibiting law-abiding 18 to 20-year-olds from carrying a handgun in public for self-defense is consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Based on the Second Amendment's text, as informed by founding-era history and tradition, the court concludes that the Second Amendment protects against this prohibition. Now, again, that ruling applies to that specific case. It applies to the people that brought that case. But the precedent is going to affect future lawsuits. And the state of Texas, not wanting to deal with all of those future lawsuits, is either going to have to change its position and allow 18-year-olds to carry so that all the 18-year-olds in Texas don't sue them all at the same time, or they can appeal the lawsuit, which, of course, they're doing. The Texas Department of Public Safety is appealing that lawsuit at this time. And yet, there's a lot of continuing cases that we see and rulings. Like in September, the Maryland Court of Appeals applied this Bruin decision and the Bruin test to a case called the Matter of Rounds. And they were challenging the state's requirements. Maryland is kind of a mess. I used to live there, so I know this firsthand. They required that a person who wanted to carry a firearm must have a good and substantial reason in order to be granted that. And the court found that this requirement was unconstitutional. It was a barrier to people exercising a right that had no historical foundation, and so it was thrown out. Again, the gentleman, Mr. Round, is now able to get his carry permit, but the principle, the precedent is there, and Maryland is going to have to address this. And something really interesting has started happening in the last few months. Remember that New York passed a whole bunch of brand new laws to try to get around the fact that they just lost the Sullivan Act. Well, lawsuits pertaining to most of those laws or chunks of those laws have been hitting the courts, and the rulings are finally coming back. So in November, November 8th, there was a ruling from U.S. District Court Judge Glenn Sutterby, and he issued an injunction blocking New York State from enforcing big chunks of the New York Concealed Carry Improvement Act. the Concealed Carry Improvement Act was kind of the main replacement for the Sullivan Act. And he just blocked big chunks of that law, specifically the subjective, quote, good moral character, unquote, requirement. That required that people who are applying for concealed carry permits would give to the state the names and contact information of other adults in the home and all of their social media accounts so that the state could decide whether they had, quote, good moral character, unquote. So, based, again, on the Bruin decision, Judge Sotheby threw that out. He also threw out the ban on carry in sensitive locations. So the idea that you could prevent people from carrying inside of healthcare facilities, theaters, churches, bars, public transportation, airports, all of that he took out. Now, earlier on, there was actually a discussion by New York legislators to include private automobiles as sensitive locations, which is just crazy. I can see why that didn't make it into the final cut. Wasn't actually included in the actual final passed legislation. But even that sensitive location ban that did make it into the law, now been struck down. For the record, that was a Gun Owners of America case. So, again, well done, Gun Owners of America. I do really appreciate these firearm lawyers who take these cases to the states, sue the states directly, or sometimes sue the federal government over these unconstitutional laws so that they can be overturned judicially. And also in New York, we had a ruling last week on the 23rd of this month. Judge John Sinatra, the case was Christian versus Negrelli. He blocked the private property exclusion. This was something that was inside that Concealed Carry Improvement Act, saying that it's a felony for you to have your firearm on private property unless there's a very special sign that the private property owner has posted publicly. And this is what the judge wrote. Property owners indeed have the right to exclude, but the state may not unilaterally exercise that right and thereby interfere with the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens who seek to carry for self-defense outside of their own homes. Thus, the motion for a preliminary injunction enjoining defendants' enforcement of this private grounds exclusion is granted. So there will be no enforcement of that particular part of the law. At this point, it would probably be better to keep track of which parts of that law are still allowed. More of that law has been struck down than upheld. I expect, with all the cases that are pending, we will still have a continued trend of unconstitutional laws being struck down and more freedoms being returned to private citizens. One more case that I'll mention, because it's actually kind of boring going through just case after case, fun as it is. U.S. versus Price. This was decided in October. So last month, Judge Joseph Goodwin addressed a piece of federal code. The federal code, section 922K, states it shall be unlawful for any person knowingly to transport. Essentially, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it basically is the law that says that your firearms must have serial numbers on them and that any firearm that's had the importer's or manufacturer's shield number removed, obliterated, or altered, anyone who possesses that firearm is in big trouble. And he ruled that that section of the federal code is indeed unconstitutional, and this is what he wrote about it. Firearms with no serial number are just as bearable as the same firearm with a serial number. And there is no common use issue here, as the presence or lack of a serial number makes no difference with respect to whether the type of weapon is commonly used. Finally, I can find no authority for the idea that a firearm without a serial number would meet the historical definition of a dangerous or unusual firearm. I'm actually going to link to his opinion because it's very interesting to read. He goes through a lot of history. He explains how the serial numbers were actually required in 1968 by specific legislation, how that was actually applied. He makes a lot of cases about the difference between carrying and owning and bearing arms versus the commercial transactions involved in firearms and how those can potentially be separate and legislated separately. But this issue of having firearms in your home that you own requiring firearms, that is completely outside of the commercial transaction process. You already own the gun. This is a ban, this code 922K, is a ban on you possessing an item that doesn't have a serial number, and he just threw that out as unconstitutional. Again, this case applied to one person, one case in particular, but the precedent here is really, really good, and this decision reinforces the Bruin precedent, and it's going to be cited, along with Bruin, on all kinds of future cases that have to do with home-built guns, 3D-printed guns, ghost guns, 80% lowers, micro-stamping, smart guns. all of these other small infringements on firearms that have people been nibbling away at, this decision that came down based on the Bruin decision actually undercuts a whole bunch of those. The arguments for why you cannot punish people for having firearms where the serial number has worn off applies to all of these other cases, and it will come up in future cases that have to do with these things. Now, of course, the U.S. Price decision is also being appealed by United States lawyers and attorneys, but this nevertheless indicates a pretty significant change here. In the past, as far as I can remember, the judicial precedent related to firearms was not good. There were definitely good judges out there, but the precedent that they were applying had so shifted and changed over time, it had lost all, I would say, historical connection to the Constitution. There was so much precedent that had nothing to do with the Constitution and the original intent of the founders that is really good to get back to that. In the past, legislation was the most effective tool for fighting for firearm freedoms, not necessarily the courts. And legislatively, we've had a lot of wins. We've seen concealed carry exploding across the nation, and now we are seeing constitutional carry in almost half of our states in the country. And this year, in the past midterm elections, every governor who signed a concealed carry bill won re-election this year. So I don't want to throw shade at the legislative process because it has been working well. But now we actually have a very good judicial precedent and test for regaining some firearm freedom. So this is a very effective tool that we have moving forward that we did not have even in early June of this year. So I'll give you an example. A little bit earlier this year, in the 2022 legislative session, before the Bruin decision had been handed down, we tried to push a number of firearm bills here in the state of Tennessee. And I'm not going to say which bills, but there were certain bills that made certain legislators, I'm not going to say which legislators, somewhat uncomfortable. They were very worried about a bill that was that expansive or that blunt or that clear, inviting a federal lawsuit against the state of Tennessee that would go poorly. That was a very scary prospect for them. But this year, this legislative session that we're going into this January, we now have the Bruin decision. So the boot is kind of on the other foot. Not only are we willing to risk a federal lawsuit, I believe that on this particular topic of Second Amendment rights and firearm freedoms, we invite federal lawsuits. The Bruin decision is some fantastic ammunition for taking some of these fights into this judicial arena. And legislators can set up those battles by enabling some of those lawsuits to happen. So I'm extremely excited to see what actually happens with a new legislative session, not a weird knee-jerk special legislative session like the one that the New York called, but what happens when people who were elected in these midterms, and again, governors who were pro-gun got reelected. Candidates who were pro-gun tended to get elected. Didn't matter whether they were red or blue. Pro-gun legislators got elected in the 2022 midterms, which means that we potentially have, going into 2023, legislatures across the country that are more likely to have gun freedom proponents and more likely for even the non-gun freedom types to see the value that the voters see in firearm ownership and self-defense. And we also have the Bruin decision. We also have a tremendous precedent for actually taking some of these cases that invite federal lawsuit and seeing those as likely wins as opposed to likely losses. So I predict that next year we're going to see a lot of interesting action on this particular front, and it will be very exciting. Some of you have noticed that there haven't been any political newsletters from T-Rex Arms recently, even during that really hot political election season. And the reason for that is that, well, personally, I find the election season to be the least interesting of all of the political seasons. Legislative sessions, especially with some of the changes that have just happened, that's what's really fascinating. That's the stuff that we here at T-Rex like to lean into and work on, and that's the stuff that we want to write about in the political newsletter. So keep an eye out for that if you're not subscribed to the political newsletter. There's a link to it at the bottom of the show notes. So we're going to be focusing on trying to write some more political material this coming year, but also making the most of the opportunities that we have in this upcoming legislative session.